Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. We're on breadboxmedia.com. Today's podcast is about some miracles, but not the ones you usually hear about. They're rather extraordinary miracles in there. Well, I'm sure that most of our listeners know the New Testament, know the Acts of the Apostles, and know the miracles that are described therein. And very likely, mostly, they believe them. I do. But that's not the subject here today. We're talking about some that there's a question about their authenticity. I'm going to talk about some of those that are in some of the apocryphal documents that are legendary. These stories may be all false stories. These stories might be true. Why don't you listen a while and see what you think? Make up your own mind. But we've entitled the show, The Miracles of John's Bedbugs and Peter's Talking Dog, because there's a miracle connected with each of those, and I'll get to that. Before we look at these stories, let's take a minute to pause here. Now, how are you going to bring yourself to believe these stories of miraculous conversion? Now, some of you want to accept them at face value and say, they happen. What about everybody else? Well, everybody else, those skeptics, are confronted with three inescapable facts. These people that don't believe in them better think about this. The first fact is, it can't be denied that people did convert to the Christian faith, eventually in massive numbers. Second, the early Christian accounts of conversion starting with the New Testament attribute conversions to the great miracles being performed. Attribute them to the great miracles. Third and last, many people today, because there's many non-Christians, but a lot of critical and skeptical Christians and Catholics as well, don't think these miracles really happen. They're a little bit too frivolous for them, I guess, in some cases. Well, let's explain all three facts. One option is simply to claim that conversions happened. They did indeed happen. For reasons other than what our sources say. For some other reason than the miracles. Today, you can theorize that people back then were attracted to the Christian community. To belong to such a tight-knit group. Or they had such superior health care. They really took care of the sick. They had the first hospitals. That could be a reason to convert, couldn't it? That's a common explanation you hear. But don't abandon these sources, these apocryphal acts of the apostles. Don't abandon them too quickly. They abundantly attest that the conversions took place precisely because of the miracles. We believe in miracles today, but it's rarely because we've actually experienced a miracle or seen one. Most people who believe in miracles have not even seen one miracle, let alone been the beneficiary of one. But all those people who believe in miracles have one thing in common. They've heard of the miracles. They've heard of them. Is that they've heard of miracles. Or talk to people who actually have witnessed them. So it's reasonable to assume that, like people today, most people in early Catholicism believed in miracles. They certainly believed the stories that were found in the book of Acts. These are literary narratives, not disinterested historical records. They're accounts that have been told by word of mouth before somebody wrote them down. Or maybe somebody did write them down pretty quickly. A lot of people fail to realize that in the Roman Empire, there were 7.5 million literate people at the time of Christ's death. Now, that's only 10% of the 75 million, but that's still a lot of literate people. I, for one, as your humble historical apologist, think that we hear too much about word of mouth and oral tradition, because anything this important would have certainly been written down many times, perhaps. Maybe in the early church, people heard the stories, and most people didn't believe them. And then after they heard the stories repeated, time after time, began to consider, well, maybe it's possible. And they might have come to believe in them. and they converted, not necessarily because the apostles and their followers were really doing miracles. You know, when these stories are told with enough conviction, the story certainly proved convincing to others. And there's proof. What is the proof? People did convert, and the reasons stated that we have, and it's the only record we have of the reasons, it's always the same one. In these stories of the conversion of thousands to Catholicism, the story always includes the reason and explains it. It describes the miracles and says that the miracles are the reason for the conversion. So, what are we to make of this? Now, the Acts of John narrates the miraculous ministry of John, the son of Zebedee, while he was spreading the word abroad. Now, some of the episodes serve no particular evangelistic purpose, but do have a purely entertainment value in showing the remarkable abilities of this man of God. Among these is probably the best-known incident that involved bedbugs. We're told that after a long journey, John and his companions came to a country inn for the night. Upon lying down, John discovered, to his great dismay, that the bed was infested with the bugs. Since he needed his rest, he orders the creatures to leave him in peace. His companions find this amusing until the next morning, because they found a large throng of bedbugs awaiting John's command at the door. He wakes up and tells them, "Bedbugs, you can now return to your home in the bed." And they obediently do so. That's the entertainment miracle. Most of John's miracles are not performed for the benefit of a good night's sleep, but in order to convert the masses. None is more impressive than his effortless destruction of the temple of the great goddess of the Ephesians, Artemis. Artemis, you may know, is the patron divinity of the city of Ephesus, on the west coast of what's now Turkey. The Ephesians' dedication to her is celebrated even in the New Testament, in a scene in which her devotees cause a riot in protest against the missionary work of the Apostle Paul. In the Acts of John, we have another apostolic encounter. This time the goddess, or at least her temple, does not escape unharmed. So John gets to the magnificent temple of Artemis and confronts a large crowd, their pagan worshippers, celebrating the goddess's birthday. Ascending a platform, John challenges them to a kind of spiritual duel, that they should pray for their goddess to strike him dead. If she proves unable to do so, he in turn will pray to God to kill them. Since everybody in the crowd knows that John's able to do great miracles, he's already publicly raised the dead. They cry out for him not to do it. John urges them all to convert and then prays that the deity of the place yield up to God himself. Now, immediately the altar of Artemis split apart. The sacrifices that were on it all fell to the ground. The glory of the temple, unquote, whatever that is broken, as are the seven idols in the shrine. Half the temple falls, the roof caves in, and the priest of Artemis is killed in the collapse. Now this god of the Catholics means business, and he's patently more powerful than the greatest divinity in town. That becomes obvious. So immediately the pagan crowd delivers the expected response for such tales of Christ's mighty apostles. They all cried out, "There's only one God, that of John, and only one God who has compassion for us, for you alone are God. Now we have become converted since we saw your miraculous deeds." You may wonder how a conversion like that can occur, bam, suddenly, with no instruction about what they're converting to. But that's the way they tell a story. John encourages the crowd, explaining that God is more powerful than Artemis. And his words now have an added effect. So the people stirred up into a mob, and they rushed up and destroyed the rest of Artemis's temple. And they were yelling, "We know that the God of John is the only one, and henceforth we worship him, since we have obtained mercy from him. We have seen that our gods were erected in vain." Now, to make this conversion story complete, the pagan priest who had been killed inside the falling temple is then raised from the dead by the power of God, and he himself becomes a believer in Jesus Christ. How's that for a rousing tale? Well, there's more stories about John, plenty of them. A lot of them are outside the Bible. I mean, this is the apocryphal Acts. There's a different set of apocryphal Acts describing Peter's comparable powers. Now, one of Peter's famous animal tricks involves a talking dog. No kidding, a talking dog. So Peter came to Rome. He wanted to confront an enemy of the faith. This guy wasn't a pagan, but a sort of an arch-heretic. His name was Simon Magus, and he was ruining the faith of Christian believers in the Capital Empire by convincing them through his own spectacular miracles that his false teachings are true. Miracles convert. Now, we don't know what these miracles were, not many of them anyway, and you wonder how many magic tricks are being pulled here. Most of the acts of Peter involve miracle contests between the true apostle of Christ and this wicked corrupter of faith. When Peter arrives in the city, he learns that one of the great leaders of the faith, Marcellus, has brought the nefarious Simon under his roof. Simon Magus. So Peter is barred from entering. The heretic fears his power. But Peter's not to be deterred. There's a large dog there on a chain. So he goes over to it, takes it off the chain, and endows it with a human voice. So the dog trots off, goes into the house, goes up to Simon Magus, and says, "Peter's waiting for you outside, and he's not in a good mood." We don't know exactly the quote of the dog, but something like that. Returning to Peter, the dog gives Simon's reply. "This will be a showdown." Simon Magus wants a showdown. The animal then lay down, breathed hard, and died. Well, the result was a massive conversion. When the multitude, with great astonishment, saw the talking dog, many fell down at the feet of Peter. Others, for whom one amazing feat is not enough, asking for another miracle. And Peter responds by bringing a smoked tuna back from the dead and tossing it back into the water to swim. Once again, and I'm quoting, "Very many who had witnessed this followed Peter and believed in the Lord," unquote. In the miracle contest between Simon Magus and Peter that followed, one fantastic deed trumps another, until eventually everyone's taken aside, either with a heretic or the apostle. At one point, Simon and Peter are brought together for an official contest in the arena before all the people of Rome, including senators and prefects of the city. To ensure a fair match, the chief prefect sets the rules of engagement by sending in a slave and giving the two competitors their instructions. Simon is to kill the slave, supernaturally that is, and Peter is to revive him. So Simon went and said one word in the slave's ear, and the man fell down and died immediately. The prefect was pretty upset about this, because the slave he sent down was a favorite of his. He didn't think this would happen. And now the prefect realizes he's to blame for this good man's death. So the prefect went to Peter and said, "Look, do something. You got to do something about this man. He's a good man." And naturally enough, Peter complies, informing everyone present that God, and this is a quote, "is doing many signs and miracles through me to turn you from your sins." Then Peter tucked the slave by the hand, and the man became alive again. He raised him from the dead. Well, then, what do you think happened? The expected response. When the multitude saw this, they yelled out, "There's only one God, the God of Peter." That's the way these stories go. Stories like that can be found out through the entire corpus of the apocryphal Acts of the Apostles. But not only there in those apocryphal Acts. There are the ostensible historical accounts. For instance, we have two narratives from the early Christian centuries that describe the missionary activities of later evangelists, one active in the 3rd century and one in the 4th century. Even though these were presented as supposedly historical accounts, they more easily align themselves with tales of a holy person, that is, idolizing biography, a hagiographic biography, a highly pious and legendary kind of writing that celebrates the miraculous deeds of a Christian saint. And many of them are just made up, but made up to fit the character of the saint. There was a man named Gregory. His Greek name was Thaumaturgus, the wonder worker. Over a century after Gregory lived, Gregory the wonder worker, there was a biographical sketch done by Gregory of Nyssa. Now this Gregory was a major theologian in the Catholic Church. most famous for his contributions to the ongoing discussions centering on the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, his little story about the wonder worker shows how in the 4th century imagination, the earlier conversion of the pagan masses came through clear and compelling demonstrations of divine power, miracles. The God of the Catholics routed the gods of the pagans in a series of direct confrontations. The biography is entitled Life of Gregory the Wonder Worker. There's a story in it that when he could only find 17 Christians when he arrived in New Caesarea, that's in Turkey, when he completed his missionary campaigns, only 17 pagans remained. The entire region was filled with pagan temples, altars, and idols. When Gregory got there, a violent rainstorm forced him to enter a pagan temple. It was filled with the filthy stench of sacrifices. So Gregory purified it by making the sign of the cross, invoking the name of Christ, putting the terror of God into the resident demons. By demons, we mean the pagan gods. Gregory spent the night in the temple, saying prayers and singing hymns. The next morning, when the custodian of the temple got there, the demons appeared to him and informed him that they are now barred from the temple. Well, the custodian was furious with Gregory, but Gregory told him that his God has the power to order the pagan demons at will. So the temple custodians asked for proof. "Proof," Gregory said, and he tore off a piece of paper and writes a command to the demons. "Gregory to Satan, enter." The custodian placed the message on the altar, and only then is it able to perform his customary sacrifices. He began to grasp the fact that Gregory possessed a divine power by which he appeared to have an overwhelming superior power over the demons. So he asked for a further demonstration of this divine power, and the saint was more than happy to do it for him. Outside the temple is a large boulder, far too heavy for a human to lift. Gregory orders it to move. It levitated on its own and glided through the air to settle in another place. When this happened, the man straightway believed in the word and left everything to follow Gregory. Now, this biographical story is very definite at the end to say that this man was not converted by some persuasion or words or debates, but by the series of miracles. Now, are these stories true? I don't know. They're hagiographic, sort of magical stories, legends. They're certainly possible. It is certainly easy to be too skeptical about these stories because these miracles are rather small things in many ways compared to the miracle of being raised from the dead. But there is a term, hagiographic, or hagiography, that today has a pejorative or demeaning meaning that these were legends and not true. But the truth is, we just don't know. Certainly amazing things do happen. So a hagiography is a type of biography that puts the subject in a very flattering light, and they're often about saints. The prefix hagio refers to holiness, and it's writing about holiness. And they were often written in a style that had no skepticism or criticism. Makes the subject seem to be a hero. Well, many of them really were, so. We put it in the category of rather charming, interesting, and inspiring. But we don't have to believe it. This is Chuck Coughlin. Hope you enjoyed this little bit lighter subject I had today about talking dogs and bedbugs that obey saints. So I'll be seeing you again soon. This is breadboxmedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin, trying to set the record straight where I can, or show it its imperfection where I can. See you again.
Breadbox Media programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit crsricebowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.